On the Empire Podcast this week, we welcome two of the most exciting directors around, Alex Garland, who made his debut with last week's Ex Machina, and the force of nature that is Paul Thomas Anderson, director of Inherent Vice. Plus the usual movie news and nonsense on the movie podcast that has discovered that looking for a flat to rent in London is an up at dawn pride-swallowing siege that I will never fully tell you about. It is horrible out there, people. Horrible. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire Podcast. This week, I'm joined by just two colleagues of such lethal cunning. But to help me write their intros, I've turned to Poetweet, which is a new website that composes sonnets and other poetry formats that I can't pronounce out of your tweets. It goes back and finds your tweets, scans it for rhymes, and composes the tweet. Here we go. First up is our art house guru, Fewer's Guide. That's the name of the poem, Fewer's Guide. Mm-hmm. Crossrail and Only God Forgives. That feels like 4 points dropped. On The Godfather from the archives. A fan escaped. Welcome, Phil Dissemblian, poet laureate of the podcast. How are you?
That was quite good.
It was good, wasn't it?
Enjoyed that. I don't remember tweeting about an anteater, but it's possible.
Do you remember talking about 4 points dropped? Of course you do. You're a Spurs fan.
I'm laughing. I don't understand the joke, but.
Football.
Me neither.
The Blues beat the Reds the other day.
Oh, did they? Yeah. Oh, come on, you Blues.
I wasn't happy. Len is our online editor. You've just heard him now. This is the title of the poem, Is Gold. Kent. Halfway through Superman 2, and I've a dragon to discipline. Good man! Empire forums are back online. James Dyer, that's amazing.
That's pretty profound.
It is profound.
I might publish that.
And here's mine.
What's the website that does this?
Poetweet.com. Go to that, type in your username. You can type in anyone's username. It's not one of those ones where you have to type your password in. You just type in anyone's username, and it will scan all your tweets, find the rhymes, and compose a nonsense poem. Okay, here's a proper question. This is from at No Soy Braulio. He says, I don't have your real name, sir. I'm so sorry. But he says, I'm from Mexico. It's a good start. Who is your favorite musician and who would you like to play him? Or her. Or her. Ellie Goulding, James, for example. You're a massive fan of Ellie Goulding. Literally, as we came in here to the pod booth, the Empire Podcast is now recorded at the at our massive studios in the heart of London. I'm not going to say exactly where, but Absolute Radio, Magic, they're all based here as well. So as we were walking in, Ellie Goulding, famous pop star, walked out past James. He didn't have a clue who she was.
I didn't. And someone said, that's Ellie Goulding. I was like, No idea. And then they sung that song about starry eyes. I was like, oh, right.
Yeah, that one.
I understand. My finger is in the pulse, not on, in the pulse of popular culture.
So if you were to... do you have a favourite musician, first of all? Neil Hannon from the Divine Comedy?
I was trying to, by way of explaining that I once knew about music, saying that I was very into the grunge scene of the sort of mid-90s, and very early Pearl Jam. Now, I would say, I would like to see... This is exactly where I'm going with this. Pearl Jam the movie, starring Chris Hewitt as Eddie Vedder. It's uncanny.
It is good, isn't it?
That's uncanny.
The Swedish Chef playing Eddie Vedder in the Pearl Jam biopic.
Who would play Eddie Vedder apart from me? Obviously,
Channing Tatum.
I might be busy. Channing Tatum as Eddie Vedder.
Yeah,
I don't see that.
Yeah, it would be, shall we say, a fanciful recreation that only borrows slightly from history.
A young Dougray Scott, not as he is now, old and bitter,
and appearing in Taken 3. Yeah. I don't know who would play him. He'd play himself, like he did in Singles.
It's like one more time, Eddie. You didn't quite get that. Once more, we're feeling. Phil.
What about
your favourite musician? Is it Werner Herzog? Werner plays the spoons?
Yes. It isn't Werner Herzog, no. Do I have a favourite musician? I don't think I do. I just have favourite bands. Okay. I don't think anyone wants to see films about them, though, to be honest. They're all fairly niche.
Who are your favourite bands?
I like bands like...
McBusted.
The Travelling Wilburys. That would make a good movie.
The Travelling Wilburys?
The clash of egos between Jeff Lynne and
Dylan.
George Harrison and Bob Dylan and all the other big names in that ill-fated pop supergroup combo. My favourite bands, I don't think anyone cares about my favourite bands, to be honest.
Favourite band is R.E.M. So by extension, I guess my favourite musician is Peter Buck. No, let's go for Michael Stipe because that's a lot easier to cast. J.K. Simmons, really? Ian Malkovich is a big resemblance there, but Simmons has the right voice, I think. Although Malkovich would be a good choice as well. That'd be good. Although you could play him, James. You're bald with facial
hair. That's really the only prerequisite, isn't it?
That's pretty much it. Yeah. Stipe going around. This is not my temple. Being all miserable. That'd be good.
I could do that.
Yeah. Nice and easy. There you go. I think we've answered No Soy Braulio's question to nobody's satisfaction. That's good. That's a good start. Next question is from @official_Anthony, the official underscore Anthony, who says, the interwebs is going nutso over the changed Fantastic Four origin and Ghostbusters reboot. Should any franchise be sacred?
Yes.
This is one of those questions, isn't it? Yes and no, and yes and no. I mean, the thing is, I could rail about all the terrible remakes, but then you have to kind of then take a step back and concede that there are actually very good remakes. And the motivations for doing them. I think the problem is when a film is great, there is only one reason to possibly revisit it, and that's because current generations aren't going to discover it. You know what I mean? So kids today aren't necessarily going to watch Rear Window, but they will watch Disturbia.
Yeah, they'll turn off their Ellie Goulding MTV videos and they'll...
Yes, exactly. And so I understand the mentality that you can take a great film and you're essentially refreshing it for youths, you know, who spend most of their time slinging re-ups on corners and doing all that stuff that they show us in The Wire. You know, that's the only... You need to speak their language, which involves, you know, replacing Jimmy Stewart with Shia LaBeouf. And that's what one does.
At that point, you go, hang on, this is not... It's like that moment when you do your online shopping, you know, and you're like, I'd like to order a can of peas, please, and they give you a mouldy banana instead. Wait, yeah. We didn't have any peas. Oh, here's a banana.
It's like an appropriate replacement.
I ordered the Jimmy Stewart. He's given me a Shia LaBeouf. It's not quite the same thing. It's just running around the flat, running into walls and being arty. I don't want that.
Yeah. I wanted peas and you gave me Shia LaBeouf. I genuinely don't want that.
That's why you can return them for a refund.
But that's not that's obviously not a franchise per se. There's no Rear Window 2 double gazing.
Oh, right. good.
Yeah. But I mean, it's topical, this question, because obviously this week there's been news on many fronts, reboot and franchise.
Yes, there has.
Fran boot, whatever you want to call it. namely, most recently, Chris Pratt being linked with the role of the Indiana Jones role that we thought Shia LaBeouf, you know, topically, was going to fill.
Before he ruined it.
Yes,
but... In the film that doesn't officially exist in any capacity, is now lives in the space between spaces on everyone's DVD shelf. And so hence Indiana Jones Raiders. This is a topic that comes up and people get very animated about on this podcast, and I'm sure amongst our listeners as well. People do feel that this one in particular, even more than Ghostbusters, I would say, was one that people have strong feelings about. I think that's because we've seen the capital of this franchise diminish over the years slowly. From a high point, perhaps, obviously the first one. The third one was very good. My brother swears by the second one. Fourth one was an aberration. Do we want to see a fifth one? Personally, no. I think Chris Pratt, if you're going to pick anyone, is the right person. But this role, for me, is so Harrison Ford. I just don't see how you can find space.
Is it the same thing? It's the same issue I have when they talk about doing a young Han Solo movie. Chris Pratt's fantastic. We've said this in the podcast already. He arrived, if anyone watched Parks and Recreation and loved it, James, you miserable list, you know, they would have seen that Chris Pratt is phenomenal. And then he arrived in Guardians of the Galaxy. He's been in stuff like Zero Dark Thirty and, you know, he's been in the supporting roles, Moneyball, that sort of stuff. He's great. Guardians of the Galaxy, there's like a movie star, like dripping with charisma. Fantastic. But Harrison Ford, you're absolutely right, is Harrison Ford. He is one of the greats. And he owns that role. Obviously, because no one else played it. Sorry, Tom Selleck. But, you know, no one else has played that apart from that guy in that dreadful LucasArts game. You know, the one who goes, oh, I want to get it in there. Oh, it's too hard. You know that one? You know the LucasArts Indiana Jones games?
I do.
Love those.
Which were repurposed because it's full of innuendo. You don't remember this? There's a famous innuendo track. Anyway,
100% agree with you. I think this is a Harrison Ford kind of retire the shirt type of deal. This particular character, and I think this is wrought with danger potentially for Chris Pratt. It's a huge role, but he's doing so well at the moment.
Yeah.
He's always going to get compared. I think Harrison Ford, obviously, you know, he was a carpenter, then he was in Apocalypse Now, and then he was in, you know, Blade Runner and this, and you know, he was a fully-fledged movie star from the minute he steps on screen. Mm. I think Chris Pratt is still on that journey. He's really good in Guardians, I think he's fantastic, and I think he's certainly on the way to being that. But Harrison Ford, I mean, he's so good. And the other thing about it is that this was a fully-fledged movie star movie. It was like, it was rooted in the matinee era. Yeah. It had freshness, it had originality for the time. It's going to be a bit stale, I think. I think it already is a bit stale, and I would be slightly concerned. The other thing that's kind of interesting about this news is that obviously Chris Pratt was linked with that Uncharted role, which we've talked about, and that was obviously the Indiana that wasn't.
But Guardians of the Galaxy is essentially playing a variation on Indiana Jones, just Indiana Jones in space, but also a dumber Indiana Jones. You know, Indy's really smart and, you know, has, you know, there's a lot of strings to his bow, and maybe Jurassic World, in which Pratt is playing a smarter character, might convince us that he can do that. But also, there's something about Harrison Ford. He had everything. He had the voice. Pratt's voice is a little, it's not quite where Harrison Ford's, it's a little higher than that. You know, there was something about Ford is a rugged man's man, and I just think, I think Chris Pratt's fantastic, but he's not quite there. And I don't see anyone at the moment who can replicate that.
I think you're right, because Harrison Ford represented the link between sort of this new poppy Hollywood and the Gary Cooper Hollywood. Mm. And I don't think Chris Pratt's close to doing that at this point. So, yeah, I would say, if you do it with anyone, do it with him. I just don't want to see him do it, personally.
But this is, I mean, broader than all of those specific instances. It's just that there are certain characters in cinema that are so iconic, that sort of transcend eras. You talk about reinventing films for new generations. I don't think anyone needs Raiders of the Lost Ark reinventing. I don't think anyone's lost that. And he's still one of cinema's most iconic characters. And I think anyone who steps into a role like that runs a risk of being, you know, received very negatively.
And also, because there are only four, and because there's only been one Indiana Jones, apart from ill-fated LucasArts things that nobody remembers, because there's only been one Indiana Jones, it's not like Bond. It's not like where we go, normally if India had followed the Bond model, we'd be on our fourth Indiana Jones by now. We'd be going, yeah, Chris Pratt's good. Like, I think he'll do well. I think he'll follow nicely in the footsteps of James Belushi, who was an unpopular choice for the third iteration of that character, or Adam Sandler. You know, one of the reasons why I think there's a lot of excitement about The Force Awakens is that it's Harrison Ford.
Yeah.
It's Harrison Ford as Han Solo, and he's back again. And even the fourth Indiana Jones movie, which sometimes I am forced to admit exists, he is fantastic in it, and he is Indiana Jones in that film. And he's not. Sometimes you get a sense with Harrison Ford in some of his more recent movies that he is vaccinated in. I didn't get that at all with what's it called? Kingdom of the Crystal something? I don't know. But he's brilliant in that. But this is an iconic role. This is the one that's sacred for me. I don't think you touch this one. But in terms of the other news that official Anthony was talking about, so the Fantastic Four trailer, Josh Trank's Fantastic Four trailer, finally went online this week, along with the logo poster for the film, which is a very, very revamped version of the classic four. It's not in a circle anymore. Mm. It's a square.
Wow.
It's slightly different. And the origin of the Fantastic Four, if you don't know it, originally in the comics, back in 1962, four intrepid people, Reed Richards, Sue Storm, Johnny Storm, her brother, and Ben Grimm, Reed Richards' best friend, who's a bit of a knucklehead, pilot a space program. They go into space and they get bombarded with cosmic rays. It alters their DNA fundamentally. They come back and they find that they have incredible powers. They've become the Fantastic Four. So Reed Richards becomes Mr. Fantastic. He can stretch parts of his body, all of his body, in fact. Sue Storm becomes the Invisible Girl, later the Invisible Woman. Johnny Storm can flame on. He can turn his body into flame. It becomes a Human Torch. And Ben Grimm becomes the big ugly rock thing called The Thing. But this one, Josh Trank's one, is proper hard sci-fi. I interviewed him for this about a week and a half ago. He cited David Cronenberg as an inspiration, David Cronenberg's body horror as an inspiration for this movie. The trailer, if you haven't seen it, check it out, is really somber, really serious, and just teases about what the film is going to be. But it's clear that the origin of the FF, and in fact the makeup of the FF themselves, has been fundamentally changed, bombarded by cosmic rays, if you will, in a Hollywood screenwriting lab. So now they're much younger. And they don't go into space to get their powers. They seem to go in, they go into another dimension. So that's interesting. It seems to follow the Ultimate Fantastic Four comic book, but what are our thoughts on that? I mean, I'm okay with this. I'm all right with stuff like this because we'll always have the Tim Story movies, but we'll always have the comic books.
Yeah, but that's the thing, isn't it? Given that the Tim Story movies are, I think it's fairly safe to say, utterly dreadful.
Oh, they're not utterly dreadful.
They're pretty dreadful.
They're fun.
No disrespect to Tim Story, who I've interviewed, is a very nice man.
Very nice man.
Sorry, Tim.
They're fun in a kitsch kind of way. You know, Rise of the Silver Surfer is 88 minutes long. You can't go wrong with that. You know, it's got some decent sequences. And it's the film that made Chris Evans really paying on people's radar.
But it's not, I mean, by no accounts are they, you know, joining the pantheon of great comic book movies.
They are not.
So I think, you know, when you have lowered the bar in such regards to a certain extent, you know, but you've got the same thing. You could say this about JJ in Episode 7. You know, a lot of people don't like the prequels, therefore the bar for Star Wars has been lowered. Therefore, it's not such a problem to hurdle over the thing. In the same way, Josh Trank with this, you know, it's not like he's tackling a sacred cow. He's not trying to redo Raiders of the Lost Ark. He's redoing Rise of the Silver Surfer or rebooting. Fantastic Four. And so he doesn't have his work cut out for him in the same way. It's an interesting, you know, it was an interesting trailer. I think the reaction online seemed to be, rather than, hey, this is great, it was, wow, this is really good. You know, like, we thought this would be dreadful. It's not dreadful. Huh. And actually, that was the way I came to it. I'm now quite excited to see this film, so...
Yeah, it's interesting because this movie has been on utter lockdown. There's been rumors that it's troubled, you know, that you know, the script may be in flux, et cetera, et cetera. All of that, I guess, doesn't ultimately matter if the finished product is good, i.e. Titanic. But yeah, I didn't know what to expect when I sat down to see the trailer.
I'm interested to see, you know, how long it will be before Ellie Miller finds out who gave them their special powers. Sorry, that was a Broadchurch reference. Has anyone noticed the Broadchurch music is actually what scores this trailer?
Oh.
Sorry, see that? Yes, see, that's Olivia Colman's character in Broadchurch. See,
okay.
It's very topical and funny.
Okay.
That was the Broadchurch music.
It was Broadchurch music.
I've never seen Broadchurch. Should I see it? It sounds good.
I've never seen it either.
No.
Have you seen The Fantastic Four and Fantastic Four Rise of the Silver Surfer?
No, I saw the first one, though, like a year ago or a year or so ago, and it was a film of sorts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I didn't rush to see the second one. Should I? Is it better?
No.
Okay. I mean, it was fun. It was fun, but it seems like the whole superhero world, cinematic world, has moved on a lot since then. Those sort of broad, cartoony superhero movies, they're just not trying to make them anymore. They're trying to give everything a sense of, obviously, we've thought, you know, gravity and gravitas, etc. So we'll see. I don't know. This one seems harder to me as someone that isn't as familiar with the comic book origins to take these characters and make them Man of Steely or Dark Knighty in terms of real rootsiness, because they are more cartoony looking, especially
The Thing.
Exactly.
Yeah,
The Thing.
He's fully CG.
He's fully CG, and he looks like sort of the arse of a volcano at times.
That's not a bad way to look, I guess. You know,
he's not wearing shorts, is he? That was a bit of a controversy.
Yeah, there's only one shot at the end of the FF together. And they're not in costume, they're not in their traditional costume, so there's a rumour online that they may not have code names in this film, they may not have costumes in this film. It's that different, guys. It's that groundbreaking.
Should we be surprised, given that this is the director of Chronicle?
Probably not.
No.
No. Really like Chronicle, though. So that gives me hope.
Chronicle's fantastic.
Lots of visual flair and interesting ideas, visual ideas, and character work. Worked hard at the characters and made it work, and made it fresh and original, so who knows?
So we don't think Fantastic Four is sacred?
I don't think
we think Indiana sacred. Jones is sacred?
Yeah.
But we don't think Fantastic Four is.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
You're not really looking for an explanation as to why that is.
Are you genuinely, without irony, comparing the Fantastic Four movie with Raiders of the Lost Ark?
No.
Good.
I'm comparing Fantastic Four as an idea, as a concept, as a property.
It depends where you're coming from. If you're a colossal Fantastic Four comic book fan, I'm sure maybe you would. But I mean, I grew up, I was given Raiders of the Lost Ark on VHS for my 12th birthday. I had all my friends around me, watched it, and it was amazing. And that's lived with me forever. And I still think it's one of my favourite films, top 10 favourite films, easily.
But why is it different? I mean, my point was, if Fantastic Four fans don't like this, they always have the comics. Well, but we'll always have the first three Indiana Jones films.
But they don't, though, do they? They won't always have the comics.
Like,
because the Fantastic Four comic has kind of been wrapped up now, hasn't it?
It'll come back.
What I'm saying is, you know, if it were such a sacred cow, presumably one wouldn't be, you know, turning it into a burger.
And it's still available. Historically, you'll still be able to go back and get the Lee Kirby issues. You'll still be able to get all those, you know, the John Byrne run. You'll be able to get all that sort of stuff. It's not going to be completely wiped out of
expunged
history.
Expunged from history.
Or is it? But that's kind of interesting to me that, you know, you feel that way. But it's the same thing. It's like, for me, comic book movies are their own beast. What Marvel are doing with their comic book adaptations is that there's great arcs in the comic books, and they're nodding to them now and again, but they're doing their own thing.
It's interesting. I interviewed Paul Feig recently for Spy, but we talked about Ghostbusters, and he made that point. He's like, I'm not going to go around and take every single copy of people's original Ghostbusters film away. I'm just trying to do something new and fresh. And so, you know, the new Ghostbusters reboot, for me, I think it's quite a fun idea. It's something new, which is important. They're not giving us anything new with the fifth Raiders at this point. We don't know where's the freshness. You know, it's just we're doing this thing because it's a property people love. Whereas with Ghostbusters, at least he's got a new idea, which he claims will, you know, share some of the things we loved about the original.
What is that new idea, Phil? That's Phil.
No idea. What's the new idea? Well, I think it's that they're casting women in the main roles. Am I correct?
That is correct. Bing, bing, bing. You win this bottle of water. Who has he cast?
The cast has been announced, and no place for Rebel Wilson.
Yet.
She's on the bench currently, warming up on the sidelines. But currently, we've got Kristen Wiig of Saturday Night Live, Melissa McCarthy, also Saturday Night Live.
Well,
and
she guest hosted it.
Guest hosted it, yes. Leslie Jones and Kate McKinnon, also of Saturday Night Live.
So he's a big Kids in the Hall fan. That's one thing we've gleaned from this. It's Feig, not Feig. That's interesting, isn't it?
It is Feig, yes.
It is Feig.
I've been calling him Paul Feig for years. So
because of Kevin Feige. I think that's the thing. It's Kevin Feige, but it's Paul Feig. I don't know. This world is weird.
Yeah,
but yes, Melissa McCarthy is obviously the go-to gal for Paul Feig. This will be his fourth movie in a row with her. She was a bit of a no-brainer. Everyone, the minute he was announced as director, everyone went, yeah, it's going to be Melissa McCarthy in Ghostbusters. Kristen Wiig, obviously, on Bridesmaids, they worked together. Kate McKinnon and Leslie Jones are kind of unknown quantities. I don't think anyone in this country really knows, unless you keep up with SNL, which you would have to do through illicit means. Certainly when I lived in the States, they weren't on the show, so I don't really know a lot about them in terms of their capabilities. But he likes funny women, and I'm sure he's you know, searched the world high and wide, and you know, he's got a good collection. What I want to know is, are the roles analogous to the original Ghostbusters? So, and who's the lead? So is Kristen Wiig to me would be a good Venkman replacement. Melissa McCarthy would be a good Dan Aykroyd, Raymond Stantz, and then you could have, you know, is Leslie Jones Winston Sedmore? You know, is Kate McKinnon the Sedmore character? Who's Egon? It's interesting because I don't know their comedic archetypes that well.
No, neither do I.
I don't know how they fit into that.
This is another one of these things which sort of veers into, you know, less so than Raiders, but certainly touches on sacred cow territory, I think. I certainly have enormous affection for Ghostbusters and Ghostbusters 2, which, despite what Empire's Nick DeSalmon says, is not better than the first film.
Oh, not even close.
Oh, Nick. You know, and but equally, you know, it is a film that, you know, is quite old now, and seeing it again reinvented for another generation makes sense, you know, financially, if not necessarily creatively. So, who knows? I'm not gonna write it off. Paul Feig's very, very competent. There's some very funny women in it, but equally, I don't see it being better than the original.
I don't know about that. I love the original. I absolutely love the original. I adore it. It's one, you know, when I was a kid growing up, it was one of my favorite films. Like, I quoted verbatim. I could quote the ITV censored version verbatim. Let's be honest about that. So instead of, you know, instead of the dickless joke, yes, it's true, this man has no dick, they cut that out completely. It took me years to realize that joke was in the film. Instead of Venkman calling him dickless, sorry, instead of Ray Stantz calling Walter Peck dickless, they call him Wally Wick in the censored version. And there's no blowjob joke either. But yeah, I wonder if, you know, if you look back at Ghostbusters now, it still holds up as a film. It's quite scary still, I think, anyway. It's got a wonderful sense of place. It's a great New York movie. It's a great team movie, and it coasts by the charm of those guys. But I'm going to say something very controversial now. I don't think it's as funny as people might think it is. Genuinely don't think that. It coasts by on gentle charm, which is a very Ivan Reitman thing to do. But I don't think it has belly laugh after belly laugh after belly laugh.
It's also not an out-and-out comedy.
It's not.
I mean, it's very much of that era, is it? Where it's kind of, I don't know if I'd necessarily call it a horror comedy, but I guess it kind of is.
Comedy horror.
Yeah, it's a comedy horror. Whereas Gremlins is a horror comedy.
Yeah.
But
a horror-omedy.
Indeed.
But that's the point. I think that goes back to the original question of these. There was no real expectation. They were just making this film what it was. It wasn't set out as a comedy or a horror. It was just Ghostbusters, you know? And no one had done anything quite like it. It was the beginning of that era.
And what's interesting about this casting as well is that obviously the first Ghostbusters was seen very much as an SNL breakout movie. You know, Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd, or Harold Ramis wasn't SNL necessarily, but, you know, it had that feeling about it. And Eddie Murphy at one point was going to be the Winston Sedmore character. So, yeah, I think, and obviously John Belushi was going to be Venkman at one point as well, if you look back at the history of that film. So by going back to the SNL well, I think Feig has done a good job with this. A good job. I'm still intrigued to see if it's going to be a reboot. I was thinking maybe they could make it a sequel. I guess Sigourney Weaver in there is maybe the owner of a Ghostbusters franchise, but apparently not. But anyway, yes. That's a question from Official Anthony answered. I think we've wrapped up most of this week's news in it as well. Thanks very much for that, Anthony. And if you want to have your question read out on the Empire Podcast, here's how you get in touch. You can email us. We're podcast@empireonline.com. We're on Twitter as @EmpireMagazine. Use the hashtag Empire Podcast. Please do not spam us if you're a sexy naked spam bot. And we're also on Facebook as Empire Magazine. Okay, time now for our first guest. We liked Alex Garland's twisting, turning, thought-provoking directorial debut, Ex Machina, so much that we asked him to come into the pod booth after the film was released. The result was as challenging and as fascinating as you'd expect from the man behind The Big Ideas of the Beach, 28 Days Later, and yes, Dread. He was speaking to, slash torturing Phil and James. Do enjoy.
The official title for a while was Ex underscore Machina. And the underscore...
It's going to happen again.
Is it or isn't it? It was never that.
No. I think that's just it's a marketing thing. I wrote a script. If you look at the script, there's no underscore on it, right. on the title okay. page. But somebody at a poster design stage thought an underscore looked appropriate. And maybe, it looks appropriate to coding type use of language. I don't know. Yeah, I've got really no idea. So it's a bit of design, I guess.
Typographical tomfoolery.
Just a bit of unnecessary HTML is what we're saying.
How do you feel about things like that? Because as writers, when people do things like add hyphens and stuff, it drives us up the wall. I would think that it would annoy you if you saw things like that.
When it comes to marketing and selling films, I know a lot of people do get very involved in that, and they... sort of get involved in the way the trailer's cut and the way the poster looks and stuff like that, and I don't. I never have done. It's partly because I don't trust my own judgment. That is to say, I've got my judgment about what I like as posters and trailers and the way I think they should be and not spoil endings and stuff like that. And But I'm so often wrong in a kind of empirical way. So I'll see something and I'll think, well, that was a really bad trailer, and that film breaks all box office records, and equally I'll see a trailer and think, now that I really want to see, and it's tumbleweed and nothing happens at the box office and that kind of thing. So I'm the wrong person to ask, and I'm self-aware enough to know I shouldn't get involved.
Well, the trailer for this was actually really good and worked very, very well. Sometimes, do you remember the Slumdog Millionaire trailer? And indeed the poster.
I don't, no.
Which just made it look like a romantic comedy.
Right. So, but it worked.
It did work. Loads of people went to see that film.
Yeah, you'd have a difficult time setting this up as a romantic comedy, or maybe you wouldn't.
Maybe you wouldn't.
I would imagine that would be a big ask.
You can cut a trailer to do pretty much anything you want, I've learned over the years.
Right.
You could definitely cut it as a romantic comedy if that was the way that people thought, let's sell it as that. It's dangerous doing miscells, but it certainly happens a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It does.
Donald Gleeson, a very funny man.
He's hilarious, yeah.
Speaking of Donald Gleeson, there's a lovely character moment with Caleb. He doesn't get the reference. He doesn't get the reference that Oscar Isaac drops about Ghostbusters. Who are you going to call? And he's just mystified. He's obviously never seen Ghostbusters.
Right.
Which I thought was a nice way of sort of enriching that character. Are there any particular sort of other character beats of Caleb that you're particularly proud of?
Oh, I don't know. Not that I'm proud of, things that I can see that Donal's doing that are very complicated and sort of very clever bits of acting. I mean, yes, he's a very gifted comic actor, and what he can do, as a lot of comic actors do, is they can really sort of dance a line between allowing humour to enter a scene but not breaking it, keeping right. the drama alive at the same time. There's a point in the film where Ava, the machine that looks like a woman or a girl in her early 20s, is kind of putting him on the spot and saying, I can tell what you're thinking by your micro expressions. They're betraying you. And at that moment, he gets completely freaked out by what his micro expressions are betraying about him, and is also doing the micro expressions that are betraying what he's doing. And it's pretty sort of high level.
That's a complex bit of acting.
It really is, and he does that kind of stuff a lot. He's a deceptive actor, Donal, because he tricks you into. I guess this is what a lot of really good actors do. He uses a kind of misdirection to get you away from the hard work he's doing. You know, the duck's feet under the still pond that are paddling furiously, that kind of thing.
We had Alicia Vikander, who plays. Obviously, the
Ava,
the Ava and the AI at the heart of the movie in the podcast and talking about that, and she's brilliant at that as well. But she becomes
extraordinary.
Probably goes the other way in her art, doesn't she?
She's very,
less vulnerable.
Very good.
She's amazing. Yeah, I mean, what the thing about this cast is that they've got properly hard acting roles within this film. You can't get by in some of those scenes on just charisma. You have to have serious acting chops, and that's what they've all got. Alicia's a really very, very powerful actress. I saw her initially in this Danish film, Royal Affair, and it was very striking. You know, she's acting opposite some really very charismatic, powerful actors, but you kind of look at her, and it's not because the other actors aren't good. It's because she's magnetic, and she's got a lot of control over, yes, sort of technical acting stuff, but also a particular kind of control over physicality that I think comes from a ballerina's training. She was a ballet dancer at a high level for many, many years as a young girl and a teenager. So she brings all of that. Yeah.
A lot of control, because her movement's all very precise, very, very particular. Do you know
the uncanny valley thing?
Yeah.
So what she was doing was the uncanny valley, basically.
Yeah.
In action, she was doing uncanny valley. And so it's so perfect, it feels slightly wrong to us, but is also kind of perfect too.
The dance sequence, which I, in common with everyone else at the screening I attended, loved thoroughly.
Great, cool.
Tell me about what direction you gave the two of them. For that,
I didn't give any direction.
Come on, you must have
disco dance.
Throw some I don't shapes. Know how to disco dance. I mean, Oscar Isaac obviously has a bit of a musical background. He can do this stuff. I'm sure his eyes closed.
Sonoya, the other actress in the film, it's a four-hander really, although it tends to get talked about as a three-hander. Like Alicia, she's a trained ballerina and a dancer. And in terms of direction, there was a choreographer, a guy called Arthur Peter, came in who was. He's a brilliant choreographer and a very kind of celebrated choreographer. He also won like the UK Disco Dancing Championship
right.
in like 1997 or something. I don't know where it was. But so
they're not your moves?
No. I wish they were. I wish they were. I can barely walk across a room.
Did you pick the tune though?
I called a friend of mine who's very good at music and I said, hey, give me a good tune. He said, I've got it.
Just the one. He didn't send you a selection.
No, he said, look, this is the guy that Daft Punk was, you know. No, I'm not going to finish that sentence. he said that this is the kind of thing that contemporary music is very influenced by. And So I said, great, and listen to it, and I knew it already.
But he
said, look, this is the one to use, and I said, thanks very much.
Tell us what it's called, just for the listeners.
I think it's Get Down Saturday Night, Oliver Cheatham.
Yeah, it's a heck of a track and a great moment.
It was.
It's going to be one of our moments of the year. Go on. So, who's your unsung hero on Ex Machina then?
Well, you could look at all of the. All right, I'll tell you what. I was going to give a sort of diplomatic answer, but I'll give a specific one. Michelle Day, right? I've worked with Mish on several movies. In fact, actually, I've worked on her with almost every movie I've been involved with in a particular kind of way, and. She comes up with ideas that make their way into the film. She's involved in production design, specifically what is on the set and why it's on the set, the physical objects and where they are and stuff like that. The dressing of the set, basically. And she comes up with ideas that often change a film quite significantly. And her name is lost in the rollers at the end of the credits. In Dread, for example, she came up one day and said, I think that the character of Mama, who's the antagonist in Dread, should have a bath in the middle of her room where she gets stoned, right? She should get stoned in the bath because wouldn't that be great, you know? She kind of relaxes there. And so she brought the bath in and set it up. And then I spoke to Lena and said, how about being in a bath? Are you cool with that? And that leads to... some material shot by Anthony Dodd-Mantle, the DOP, on a Phantom camera, and then some beautiful VFX work overlaid by that by John Tum, the VFX guy. Some of the absolute standout shots in that film of someone getting stoned in a bath and some amazing iridescent stuff happening all around her, which is attributed to a director. And it had literally, and I mean literally, nothing to do with a director. Nothing. In Ex Machina, there's a really beautiful moment in the film, as far as I'm concerned, I mean, it's a subjective thing, where Ava walks past, the robot girl walks past a painting of a woman in a white dress. And the woman in the white dress is, I think, it's painted by Gustav Klimt. The painting and the woman in the white dress is Wittgenstein's sister. And Wittgenstein, the philosopher, has a role to play in the film. And it looks like a brilliant, clever directorial touch by me, allegedly, right? Which is a complex reference to art and Ava and all sorts of different things and philosophy and stuff. I had nothing to do with it. I didn't know that picture existed until I walked onto the set and she'd put it there as a kind of surprise. Mm. She deliberately held it back. So, unsung hero, Mish. But believe me, there's a ton. There's a lot of them. And their work gets attributed to people like me, and it's not me, it's them. That's basically
it's
what I'm
most,
saying.
One of the most articulate rebuttals of auteur theory you'll ever hear. One of my favourite bits of British cinema recent years, the opening of 28 Days Later.
Yeah, ripped off Day of the Triffids, go on. Yeah.
Oh, I wondered maybe it was one of the Neville shoots.
When you say the opening, you mean on the beach?
On the beach, right. In Melbourne, is it similar?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so...
No, it was kind of ripped off Day of the Triffids. But actually, Andrew and I, when we were... For a while on that film, it was just me and Andrew, the producer, just bouncing the script, for, I think, about 5 drafts back and forwards between us. After about draft 3, he said, you know what, we need to watch On the Beach. So we did.
Oh, okay. Hurrah. It's one of these films where people just seem to want to will another sequel into existence. And you've been talking a little bit about it recently. I just wondered if zombies are huge. I mean...
They're infected, Phil. They're not zombies.
Infected.
I thought I'd get in there first.
I meant zombies. No, I'm talking about zombies.
You know
zombies.
What? You wouldn't have been getting in before me. As far as I'm concerned, it's a zombie movie. I get that there's a differentiation between the living dead, but look, whatever, you know, they want to...
Right. Okay, that was my other question. Do you care when people come up and talk about...
It's a genre film. It's a... Yeah. It was a... The pitch to Andrew was at Pizza Express in Charlotte Street. And I said, how about a film with running zombies set in London with a lot of daylight? Mm. And he said, yeah. And that was it.
Bingo.
That was the pitch.
Well, The Walking Dead is huge, obviously, on TV.
Yes, it is.
World War Z was something of a success to the point where they're going to make a sequel. Does that kind of zombified landscape make it harder for you to find a third film? Or does it make you think there's just demand for this and I should look at it?
There were various issues about a third film. One of them was to do with all the key rights holders being in agreement, right? There's a lot of them.
Really? So, how many?
4.
Right.
Me, Danny, Andrew, and Fox. So that's one aspect that's a lot of ducks to get in a row in one way or another. The main sticking point was that, whether it's successful or not, in intention, 28 Days Later was supposed to have something kind of aggressive and subversive in it, particularly, well, no, both those things, but the subversive aspect of it felt like part of it tonally, I think. And what tended to happen when I was thinking about what form a third film might take, or sometimes someone else would come up and suggest an idea for what form a third film might take, is that it felt like it belonged to the world of 28, whatever it was, but not, it lacked a kind of aggression and a kind of subversiveness. And there wasn't something that felt, I mean, it's sort of banal to say this, but surprising. I mean, that is to say, it could be surprising in plot terms, but not something that felt had any kind of punk aesthetic, I guess, or something like that. But hopefully we've got an idea that does acquit that. And then what happens is you run into all the other millions of problems of trying to get a film off the ground. So yeah. we've been talking about the possibility of it, but man, there is a long way to go before you are standing on a location or a soundstage.
Of course. Well, I mean, there are very few films I can think of where the British Army end up being the bad guys that are British films.
Can I ask a Dredd question here? So I properly love Dredd. Good. And I was really disappointed when sort of there was talk there was a sequel, wouldn't happen, then it was going to be a comic. And is there any chance that we'll, you know, get traction on that?
I think you've got to look at where the talk comes from. Mm. Just speaking for myself, when we were trying to sell Dredd ages ago where we failed to get people interested in it as a theatrical release in a spectacular way, I talked about the possibilities of sequels back then, and then I hadn't really, I don't think, said anything about it then until quite recently when I was asked by IGN, I think, or somewhere or other, where I was talking about if there is a sequel, it won't be anything to do with me. And there's a simple reason for that, which is that sequels are predicated on film success, right? Mm-hmm. And Dredd was not a success financially. I'm glad you think so, creatively at least. That's really good news. So I'm pleased. But definitely not financially. And so it's very, very hard to make that case.
Mm.
What I hope, but this is now talking as a punter, right, is that the character is so strong that it deserves a sequel, or not a sequel, a reimagining or whatever it would happen to be, and that somebody else will do that. I'd get really pissed off if I thought that not only did we fail in box office terms, but we also killed off the character in cinematic terms. That would be even bleaker than it is now. So I have to hope that somebody else comes along and does a better job than we did. Sincerely.
Similar time to The Raid, wasn't it? And obviously they shared certain narrative beats and they couldn't help but...
Yeah, although I found it really mystifying, the fuss that was made about that, because I don't actually think, except in some sort of relatively glancing ways, I think the similarities are quite small, actually. That is to say, you could find similar type similarities between any heist movie within reason, let's say, or a movie set within a bank, or whatever it happens to be. So I guess that wasn't helpful, but look, in truth, when it comes to the lack of success of Dredd, I don't want to, you know, pass the buck in any way, shape, or form. We had an intention. It was an R-rated action movie of a certain sort. Other R-rated action movies like District 9 have done fantastically well. Mm. I can't see anything to blame it on, right? I just think we didn't succeed. We didn't interest people enough to go and see it. And that the responsibility for that is really with us. The Raid, from my point of view, it was uncomplicated. It still is. I'm glad it exists. Terrific movie. Like, no problem in that. It's a good thing.
Alex Garland, thank you very much for joining us on the podcast.
A pleasure.
See you for the next one, I hope.
That was fun. I actually really enjoyed that interview. He doesn't mess about.
Yeah.
He doesn't mess about.
That's evident.
Yeah.
No, I don't.
He gave us quite a kicking on a couple of those points. Phil in particular took the brunt of it. You couldn't see because it was radio, but at one point he was stepping on Phil's neck. It was an unexpected turn of events.
It really was.
Good, it wasn't my neck either.
Okay, time now for movie news. We've pretty much covered all the big stuff, although there were some things that happened towards the end of the tail end of last week. Hey, look at that, the Empire podcast went up and then Hollywood went. Here's a lot of big news. So I guess the biggest one, casting-wise, was X-Men Apocalypse. So the casting of young Cyclops, young Jean Grey, and young Storm. So it was Alexandra Shipp as young Storm, Sophie Turner from Game of Thrones as young Jean Grey, and Ty Sheridan from Mud as young Scott Summers. So interesting. There's going to be obviously an X-Men Apocalypse. So it's the new gang who are now the old gang are now going to meet the young versions of the older gang.
Who are now the new gang.
While Hugh Jackman is still knocking around somewhere and doing whatever it is that he does, which is usually kill people and grumble a bit.
Yeah.
It sounds good.
It does sound good. Very excited, actually. Particularly Sophie Turner's casting. I think that's a very good shout.
That's spot on. Spot on. Tall, redheaded.
Yeah. All the boxes ticked.
Yeah. Well, no, there's more boxes to Jean Grey than just tall and redheaded.
Tall, redheaded, telekinetic.
I think I may have reduced that role to, it's more superficial parts. But very excited about that. And also the news that Mission Impossible 5 has been... Most things in Hollywood, most films get pushed back, and then it allows people like us to go, ooh, must be trouble. I imagine that's not very good. Mission Impossible 5 has gone the other way. It's come forward from December of this year, where it would have been going up, I think, directly against Star Wars, maybe the week after.
I believe it's called We're Running from Star Wars.
I'm not so sure it is. I don't think it is. I really don't think it is. It's coming forward by 5 months. Now there's Running Away.
And then there's absolutely pegging it.
Hey, good you, man. It's good. We should have you in the podcast more often. 5 months. So it's now coming out in July. And they're still filming.
Amazing.
They're still filming right now.
Yeah.
As we speak, they're filming. Yeah. So,
well, it's a franchise that's committed to practical stunt work and practical effects. So I guess that diminishes the post-production process a little bit for them. Mm-hmm. But I mean, fair play. Bloody hell. They filed their film 6 months early.
Yeah. I would love to have been a fly on the wall when Chris McQuarrie took that phone call. I really would.
You know how you were coming out in December?
You know how you were planning to sleep?
What would you say if we said...
It's okay, Chris, we've hired assistants to sleep for you. They'll do all the defecation, all the things you need to do. Just focus on the movie. That's a studio executive. Right. Interesting. I think it's interesting.
Oh, it's good. We
it's
get to
clearly
see it
a sign of confidence, although you could also argue, if you were being cynical, mm-hmm. that Paramount moved one of their movies, Monster Trucks, which sounds great, to the end of the year from May, and that they had a slot. They need something to make some money in the summer months, and they brought that forward.
Do you think Star Wars will now have to move to get away from Monster Trucks?
I think so. Run!
That's always a worry.
It's a monster truck! It's got Danny Glover in it! Right.
New biggest, issue time.
Biggest bit of news is that the new issue of Empire is, I'm holding up, I don't know why, is now on sale. £3.99 at all good and evil newsagents. On the cover is Avengers Age of Ultron with all the team, all the team. So we have Armor Bloke, Shieldy Fella, Iron Man, Captain America, Black Widow, Hawkeye, the Hulk, look at that, amazing. Thor, Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch. No Vision now. They're still holding back Vision.
There's
on
only one
the cover,
Vision.
Assembled on the cover. Inside, my cover feature. Good Queen reference. We're keeping them up. It's good.
Well, I thought we did Alanis last week. We could do Freddy all this week.
Yeah.
Touched on immortality already. Otherwise, I'd have done the Who Wants to Live Forever. But anyway, let's move on.
Okay. Cover feature, Age of Ultron. I went and set. I spoke to Joss Whedon, Kevin Feige, the whole gang, Robert Downey Jr. Got lots of stuff, lots of scoop on Civil War, Captain America Civil War, and Joss Whedon's future with the franchise, i.e. he's probably going to step down as director following Age of Ultron because of the aforementioned problems that are going to assail Chris McQuarrie in the next few months, lack of sleep and, you know, all that stuff. So, yeah, it's. I think it's really good. I really enjoyed writing this feature and I hope you guys enjoy reading it as well. Loads of great stuff inside the issue, though. As to quote the great Chris Evans, we have a fantastic interview with Margot Robbie, who will soon, of course, be Harley Quinn in DC's Suicide Squad. We have Nick Disemlian talking to Neil Blomkamp and Charlton Copley about Chappie, which is Blomkamp's new movie about a nicer robot than Ultron. We have a feature on In the Heart of the Sea, Chris Hemsworth and Ron Howard's whaling drama, which was literally pushed back 6 months the day after we went to press. We have Jennifer Aniston in the Empire interview.
Yes, this is Jennifer Aniston as interviewed by Empire's Ollie Richards, the world's biggest Friends fan.
Yes, so, he outfriends me, which is...
It's a great interview. He did a really good job.
Yes, good feature with Michael Mann. And hey, you never guess, Chris Hemsworth, who features three times in this issue for Michael Mann's Black Hat. It's a really good feature.
Thor,
no matter what, you've
the God
have heard
of Thunder
about
and Lightning. Very, very frightening. Sorry, carry on.
Are we exhausting your knowledge of Queen stuff?
You're basically exhausting my entire knowledge of music at this point. We'll do Ellie Goulding next week.
Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark. There's a great feature on Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark. Inside as well, we also have set visits from the likes of Ant-Man, Robot Overlords. There's lots of robots. Entourage. You can read how Nick Disemlian watched Turtle reverse into a parking space for an entire day. Alicia Vikander's in there. Sam Taylor Johnson takes us through 50 Shades of Grey. We have a piece on the gunman. John Lithgow. There's a really fun John Lithgow interview in there. And this month's Pint of Milk, and I did it myself and I can't remember who it is. There it is. Jim Parsons. Sheldon from the Big Bang
Dr.
Theory.
Sheldon
and he
Cooper.
Was a delight. Absolute delight.
Can we do an issue spoiler? How hairy is his ass?
It's a five.
It is a five.
It's
you're
a
right.
Five.
On a scale of 1 to 10,
on
remember?
A scale of 1 to 10, yes. Not just, this is always the difficult thing for anyone out there who wants to be a journalist. If you ever end up working for Empire and you have to do a pint of milk and you have to ask a celebrity how hairy their ass is, do remember to append the phrase on a scale of 1 to 10. Yes. Which Phil continuously forgets
give them
and
something.
Just says, how hairy is your ass? Please describe to me with a number of verbs and adjectives.
Which then Eric Cantona misheard us. How airy is my house?
How airy is my house?
How airy is your house, Eric? Let's go down this
give
route
give me
for
some
a little
form
bit.
Of scale to work with. What, so, maybe a 1 to 10.
What is happening?
1 is a slight breeze. 10 is a hurricane, Eric. I don't know why I'm doing an accent like this. But we are now friends. Okay, so that's it. Plug over. Movie news over. Let's move on to our second guest now. Paul Thomas Anderson may not have directed Event Horizon to his eternal regret, like his namesake, Paul W.S., or starred in The Sweeney, like his other namesake, just Paul. But he's done all right for himself as a writer-director of evocative, brilliant movies like Boogie Nights, Magnolia, Punch Drunk Love, There Will Be Blood, and The Master. He's back this week with his latest Inherent Vice, in which Joaquin Phoenix plays a drug-addled private dick who gets embroiled in a murky mystery of Chandler-esque complexity. Another Friends reference. He came to London back in December, and he spoke to myself and Helen O'Hara. Enjoy. Tonight, you are showing Inherent Vice in London at the Prince Charles Cinema.
Yeah.
Did you choose that cinema?
I did.
Why point at Prince Charles? We love the Pritchards. It's where we had a live podcast there in February, our very first ever live podcast.
Yeah.
And they've been so good to us, and we just love that place. So
I love it too, and I've been there a few times in the past, and it seemed like a great place to show the movie. In by that I mean, well, first they're still showing 35mm, which is great.
Yeah.
I think I had an idea, maybe when making this movie, that it kind of should play good at drive-ins or revival houses. And maybe what I mean by that, and when we were doing a run-through this morning, and I just got so excited and tingly because I saw it on that screen, which is not the biggest screen in town, and it's not the best screen in town.
Yeah.
It had all the kind of rough edges of what it is, which is a repertory second. I don't know what you call them here, but a secondhand store, I guess. I mean that in the best way. You know, that's where all the good stuff is. That's where the stuff I go to see is usually. So yeah, it was seemed like a great fit for this movie. But they used to have like a marquee out front, though. I remember.
Yeah, they had a balcony.
Well, they had the balcony, right? But then out front, they had like a kind of old wraparound or something like that. But that's not there anymore, is it?
It's all gone. It's all
I think that's all gone, yeah.
Progress, apparently, has taken them. We still love the cinema. It's fantastic.
Yeah, it's true.
We'll hopefully do another live podcast there in the not-too-distant future. But the film itself, I mean, you talked about Inherent Vice here. It has this wonderful, woozy 70s vibe. But is that the 70s... you remember because you were...
No, I was born in 1970.
Yeah, so...
And you know, the funny thing is, I keep... This is an important distinction. It's 1970, so it's the 60s.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, that's the thing. I mean, I remember when we were making it, and people would say, like, oh, this movie about the 70s. I was like, fuck off, we're making a movie about the 60s. Come on. But I do it myself, too. I think it's the thing with this movie is that it's about a transitional time. It's clearly like... the war between the sort of revolution that the youth could kind of come along and change things and get something done, at least in America, was coming to an end, that they'd really kind of lost that battle. And, you know, that's what the book is about. That's what Pynchon's going on about. That's kind of a kind of common theme in a lot of his work. So do I remember it? No, I don't. But I do remember what it felt like when I read the book the first time.
Yeah.
I mean, this is kind of the first adaptation of a Pynchon novel. I read Gravity's Rainbow earlier this year, which was...
Oh, you're better than I am. I couldn't get through it. It's too hard.
To be honest, yeah. It was incredibly tough going. It's, I mean, amazingly rewarding at the same time because the writing is just so gorgeous, but... Jesus.
Oh, it's a chore. I know, it's hard.
I mean, will there be another? You know, is this the only Pynchon adaptation, do you think?
Oh, I hope not. I hope somebody else does something one day. I mean, I'd even like to do something else of his. Having, you know, Vineland is another great book that I think could be adapted. Mason and Dixon is a great book that could be adapted, which, sure, I'd love to try someday, but... Gravity's Rainbow, too smart for me. I couldn't get through that. Congratulations. That you did.
Thank you. I'm going to take that because I totally deserve it.
Yeah, no, I know. When I first sort of heard about Pynchon, I went out and got Gravity's Rainbow, and I read one page. I was like, you've got to be kidding me. There's no chance. And then I have read Gravity's Rainbow, a lot of it, but it's so challenging, and I think now I could get through it that I understand his work better. So. Try again someday.
I would love, when you do, please come back, explain it to me.
Sure.
And then tell me what I just read. Awesome. Thank you.
So it's a page a year, maybe. Is that
Yeah.
Get the 12 pages.
I mean, you do a lot of rereading when you read Pynchon, and that's I have to say that's kind of okay. You know, if you have the time and you have the will and it excites you enough on the first go around that rereading it is sometimes more rewarding than reading it, and that should be a bad thing, I suppose. You should be able to get through it, but the joy of kind of sometimes these books take you places that you don't expect it to go, and that as a reader or you can kind of get frustrated by that, and that's on you more than anything else. So you've got to give over to whatever it is he's going to give you. And so there's a phrase, the only thing more rewarding than reading Pynchon is rereading Pynchon. So that's enough about my literary.
I think that's probably true. I mean, this one as well has a similar sort of I felt like it was it made complete sense, and I wasn't quite there yet, but it was totally making sense, and it felt like it was exactly the midpoint between sort of PI film noir logic and dream logic. Like, it was, you know, completely posed between the two the whole time, because things just happen that kind of make sense, I guess.
Yeah. Well, as long as they're vaguely plausible, that's kind of... I take that as high compliment, and I think that's a good feeling to have from the film, that, you know, the dots do connect. You don't have to worry about that. If you really want them to connect, they do. But the most important thing is just sort of riding along with this hero and his kind of haze and getting to the next girl, you know, to flirt with or to get information from or to, you know, Pynchon has a way of kind of presenting these stories that are at their best overly convoluted, and that's kind of the joy, is that it can kind of remind you of reading the newspaper every morning where your fucking head is done in because you can't believe how kind of complicated and sad and fucked up things are, you know. But he does it in a way that makes you have fun, you know. You can have fun with it if you go with it. And oh, it's not homework. It shouldn't be frustrating. It should be fun.
No, it is, I think. And also, like, amazing characters and character names also. Yeah. Just like, you know,
yeah,
it's just kind of a joy to hear about people called things like Shasta and Puck. And
Puck Beaverton, Shasta Faye Hepworth, Rudy Blatnoid. What are some other good ones? Japonica Fenway. Crocker Fenway. Denis rhymes with penis. His name is actually about D-E-N-I-S, but he's going to make it rhyme with penis. Sortilege. Yeah, it's a long list. He's always been great with names. Mm. So.
It's fantastic. And I read an interview with you a couple of months ago where you also said that one of the touchstones you had in your head when you were making this film were the movies of Sucker, Abrahams, and Sucker.
Yeah. Now, Zaz.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm always banging on the podcast about Top Secret, which is just about the greatest comedy of all time for me.
I saw some Top Secret the other night, and it still holds up. It's so fantastic. I mean, endless gags.
Mm.
Well, you know, what I meant by that was, what happened was, in Inherent Vice, there's a sequence where Doc, it's a little bit in the movie, where Doc goes to the Wolfman Mansion, and the LAPD are, they're meant to be, you know, setting up a surveillance case for a kidnapping, and really they're fucking around, they're swimming in the pool, and they're frying up cheeseburgers, and they're, like, you know, playing ping pong, which, you know, if you come from where I come from, that is the LAPD. That is exactly what they're like. They're kind of, you know, wrong, foolish, and goofy. And so it reminded me of those secret, I mean, the way he wrote about it reminded me of those great sequences in Police Squad, where, you know, you have this outlandish stuff going on. But the irony was, it wasn't that far from the truth of the history of the LAPD and some of their behavior at certain crime scenes. I was like, this feels like a Zucker Brothers movie, the way he's describing it. But it's also actually how shit went down. So that was this kind of weird hook into sort of going back to that stuff, which I know really well anyway, but it was just an excuse to say, this is a good way to watch this stuff again and get excited to get back into Inherent Vice, to maybe squeeze some of that into the film. I mean, it was sort of perfectly described and historically accurate for the LAPD. So they're like a Zucker Brothers movie.
So do you set yourself homework almost when you're preparing a movie? Do you watch other movies to get inspiration from them? Or
yeah, I mean, I think a bit of both. I mean, sometimes you don't want to see things that you know already, and you want to stay away from things, and you're just, and other times, you know, I went back to watch The Big Sleep just because I'd seen it, but I realized, okay, we're making a detective movie, which I never thought in a million years I'd make a detective movie. And was like, if anything, I thought, I'd, you know, there's a million other types of genres I thought I'd make a movie of first.
Mm.
But seeing The Big Sleep again and sort of revisiting some of these things was helpful in terms of releasing. I think I've talked about this before, is that you free up thinking that the important thing is solving the crime or following the plot, that, you know, that there are other reasons to do a detective story. I think if anything, there was more like a good excuse with this movie to listen to Neil Young records over and over again.
You know, do you need an excuse?
Not that I need an excuse, but now you could call it homework, you know, and say like, oh, wow, you know, just to get your head in the right space and try to think like, if we could try to make this movie feel like a Neil Young song, you know, that we'd be on the right track. Let me just listen to that Neil Young album again. I've got to go to work.
Another 10 times, so might as well. It's homework.
You know, you got to put it on the drive on the way to work every morning and, you know, try to get yourself in that headspace. And yeah, yeah.
I saw Doc called a gum sandal rather than a gum shoe, which is brilliant. There's a recurring theme of the grossness of his feet from Around All Day in Sandals, which I also liked. But it seems very part of his sort of LA character, and it's, you know, the noir detective is so associated with LA particularly.
Yeah.
Which is weird if you think about it, because somehow the genre should really feel more at home somewhere slightly darker, like Chicago or something.
Yeah, like New York. Or yeah. Yeah, I know.
Basically, just sort of, you know, is this a sort of a continuation, a sort of a weird off kilter evolution of the original film noirs? I guess so.
I mean, that was what Pynchon, you know, I think he used the device obviously to like to fuck around, and you know, I think in he sort of considered this his beach read, you know, like how to use a detective story as a kind of dressing to have somebody kind of walk through the remnants of what's happened to his generation, you know, what's happened to all these ideas. These people have had these brilliant ideas floating around. It's kind of an excuse, really, I think, to do that. But you've got, I'm sorry, I'm kind of off my train. You've had me thinking about Joaquin's feet, which were so disgusting. I mean, he didn't wear, you know, he really gets into stuff. And even like 2 months before we were shooting, he wasn't wearing shoes. And his feet were so fucking disgusting. I can't tell you. We didn't really do it justice. I wish I'd gotten more shots of just how disgusting his feet were. He didn't wear shoes for 6 months. It's fucking disgusting.
Yeah, that's not nice.
No, it wasn't. But perfect, I have to say.
Well, exactly. We talked to Reese Witherspoon recently, and she was saying that it was almost like it seemed like a series of short films to her, because people would come in for a couple of days at a time. You know, she came in, did a bit. I gather that they spent most of their time giggling and reminiscing about Walk the Line. Is this the case, and you had to kind of whip them back into shape?
Yeah, you know, I do remember sitting there thinking, there's a little too much fun happening here. There's a little too much giggling going on, and I did have to say, that's enough of that. We have to start rolling. And she's right that it was like a series of short films, very episodic. Hmm. So just as soon as you really had a good time with somebody, sort of 3 or 4 days into it, and then they're gone on to the next thing. But yeah. Yeah, there was a lot of giggling between Reese and Joaquin.
But the one person who's obviously a constant is Joaquin, mm-hmm. who's in virtually every scene. There's that scene between Josh Brolin and his wife, but clearly Joaquin wasn't there for.
Right.
Can't really think of too many other scenes that he wasn't
there. Yeah, but he's on the phone in the other room. So, yeah. You know, he was... there was nothing that we didn't do without him, I have to say.
So he was even there for that? He showed up to
be on the phone.
Wow. Yeah. Okay.
I can't think of anything that we did without him, but that's great. If there's anybody you want to work with every single day, it's Joaquin.
Yeah.
I mean, really, you know.
He doesn't get credit for being much of a comedian, but he's really funny here.
I agree with you. It would hate me for me to say this, but this is the most like Joaquin. The Joaquin that I know, I mean, is really this funny and sweet and kind of... lovable, to me at least.
He does.
It reminds me of him.
There's an amazing...
I mean, he's not at all like the guy in The Master. Nothing, you know. I mean, he's nothing like that. So, and I think people's impression of him is that somehow he's this weird weirdo, and he's not that weird. He's just so sweet.
Yeah. There's an amazing reaction shot. It is in the trailer as well, where he gets bonked in the back of the head.
Yeah.
And he turns around.
And he tries. Yeah. Yeah, he goes down fighting.
It's an amazing, amazing bit of physical comedy, and it's just so quick as well. I mean, how many... Was that something that came naturally to him, and that side of things?
I think I get credit for that one. Benicio saw the movie, and he said to Walk, he said, "Oh man, I, you know, I've been trying to figure out a good way to get hit on the head and fall down in a movie for so many years. You know, I just go for the fall." And he was like, "You came up with a good one." And then I guess I said to Joaquin, "I think you should go down swinging." So then he had to, you know, so that I get credit for that one.
It's so good.
But he did it so well.
Obviously, back in the very, very early days of the movie, Robert Downey Jr. was linked to the film. In an interview I read with him about a year and a half ago, he said that you told him he was too old for the role. Right. Did that conversation take place?
It did take place, but you know, in this day and age, it's so weird. You can't meet with somebody about. We were never really that too serious about making this film. We were just sort of like talking about it, and then things get reported on, and then you've got to answer for it. When it's so strange, as you know. But I don't think look, Robert Downey can do just about anything, and he probably would have been great. But I thought Joaquin was better to play this part. Yeah. I did tell Robert Downey he was too old.
How did he take that?
Took it like a man, you know?
Weeping, gnashing of teeth.
Exactly.
The usual stuff.
He took it like, well, okay, I'm going to go cash this $65 million check in the bank while you make your stupid little beach movie.
1-0. Well, Paul Thomas Anderson, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot. Thank you.
Okay, let's start the review section. Phil, I know you have to run very, very quickly. Who are you doing today? Who are we interviewing today?
We may be interviewing Bill Nighy, although I can't possibly comment.
Okay.
Is he coming into this room to be interviewed?
No.
Okay, so you're leaving, you're not kicking Chris and I out.
We're going to the boat that rocked. The hotel that rocked.
Amazing. Amazing. All right, so let's start with Inherent Vice.
Yes.
Phil Catt.
Yes.
People have heard the interview, the Paul Thomas Anderson interview, but tell us about this film.
Okay. This film is Paul Thomas Anderson's adaptation of Thomas, more pronunciation trouble straight away, Pynchon or Pynchon. I can never work it out.
Pynchon.
Thomas Pynchon. It's his seventh novel and the first, to the best of my knowledge, and I could be wrong, and if you've listened to my Alex Garland interview, you'll know that happens quite often. The first it's one to be adapted.
Alec Garland.
Yeah. Hey, Steve. Alex, Steve, whatever. The first to be adapted for the big screen, and that's no coincidence because his books are impenetrable at times in the best possible way. He's one of the great American novelists of the last 50 or so, 100 or so years even. I have read Mason and Dixon. It took me 6 years and I got as far as the and. It's really, really thick stuff. And so making this film, it gives you an idea of kind of what you're wading into. It's basically the story of a guy played by Joaquin Phoenix.
Well, that's Joaquin, the weirdest
Joaquin. Joaquin Phoenix.
Joaquin Phoenix. Phoenix.
It's hello, Joaquin. My name is Joaquin Phoenix.
You killed my father. It's that sort of film. You can't work out what's happening. Joaquin Phoenix plays Doc Sportello, who's somewhere between, he's probably the midway point between Elliot Gould playing Philip Marlowe in The Long Goodbye for Robert Altman and the dude in The Big Lebowski.
Yeah.
He's a very stony, very hipster. He keeps getting accused of being a hippie.
Yeah.
He's not really quite a hippie. He's more of his own thing, really. And into his life comes his ex, played like a beautiful Zephyr. Catherine Waterston drifts through this film as Shasta Faye Hepworth, his ex, and she's got a missing boyfriend, this guy she's having an affair with.
You're beginning to try and explain the plot.
I'm not going to try and explain the plot.
Because it's...
No.
Anderson says it ties up, but
I'm just going to say, if you look at the plot or the synopsis in Wikipedia, it's actually longer than the book. So it really, I won't do that. But what I will say is that the investigation takes Doc drifting through this amazingly sort of elaborate and idiosyncratic journey that involves swastika goons, a Ouija board, a sex clinic, real estate corruption, Josh Brolin playing a guy called Bigfoot, who's a kind of a sad copper of sorts, who says things like molto panikeko. I like his performance very much.
So he's trying to pronounce Joaquin Phoenix's name as well, isn't
he? Exactly. They're all really good. It's full of great actors doing their thing, and somehow Paul Thomas Anderson pulls all this together into something that sort of coheres. I would say go into it, forget about the plot. Literally just go on the journey. You need to see it again at least once, I would say, afterwards. But there's enough in it to warrant that because it's really very funny. It's got lots of sort of texture and detail, really good performances. As I say, I would say Catherine Waterston stands out.
She's amazing.
She's really
good. Honestly thought she was going to get a Best Supporting Actress nomination.
Wouldn't have been undeserved, I think.
I don't think so, yeah.
And Joaquin Phoenix is really, really good too. It's obviously his film, his character throughout. It's top stuff. We gave it 4 stars. It falls just short of his best work, I would say. But I would agree with that.
The interesting thing for me, and if you listen to the interview, you'll have heard PTA talk about how Robert Downey Jr. was initially connected to this role. Kind of feel, even though he says his reasons, he's too old for the role, I can't help but think of that movie now. I think Doc needs to be a bit more likable than Joaquin Phoenix makes him. I think Joaquin Phoenix is a very interesting screen presence, but not a particularly relatable one for me. But for me, the film is very good. Not quite up there with his best, but still, four stars worth. Go and see it. Next up is Matthew Vaughn's latest movie, Kingsman: The Secret Service, in which Colin Firth's super spy and Taron Egerton's raw recruit from the wrong side of the tracks team up to save the world from Sam Jackson's lisping megalomaniac. Jimbo.
This is, as you say, Matthew Vaughn's latest bit of Daily Mail bait. It does, I suppose, for Bond movies, what Kick-Ass did for superhero movies, which is to say you will either love it or hate it. I, thankfully, loved it. Huge amounts of style and panache, ultra-violent, it's sexy, it's really funny, it's incredibly lighthearted, and it's, I think, the perfect antidote to, you know, really the modern Bond, which is a much more serious, you know, sort of po-face Bond. I mean, this is madness to the extreme. I can see that a couple of the more violent sequences in particular may rub people up the wrong way slightly.
Interestingly, it's not the violence that's rubbed people up the wrong way, as far as I can tell. There are people in the office and people I've met who are rubbed up the wrong way by the film's closing joke.
Yes, the sexy times.
And that, I'm not going to say anything else about. No. Go and see it and see what you think. I know what Matthew Vaughn's going for, whether he gets it or not. Is open to debate, but it seems to have rubbed some people up the wrong way. But this is an extraordinarily violent film. But for me, I'm with you in this one, James. We gave it 4 stars. I gave it 4 stars. I think it's got a lot of panache, a lot of style. It's very much a cousin to Kick-Ass in that sense. It's no holds barred. There's a church sequence with Colin Firth, which is extraordinarily violent. As I said in my review, it's like the last 20 minutes of Peter Jackson's Brain Dead meets the entirety of The Raid.
But magnificently shot, magnificently choreographed.
And really interesting in how it makes you feel about violence and your relation to it and your relation to the character committing all the violence. Because it's shot and staged in an exhilarating fashion, but you're kind of thinking, I really shouldn't be enjoying this. there's something that happens later in the film that I genuinely have not seen before on the big screen. And it's not too often you can say that. And it has divided people again. But for me, there's something really interesting about Vaughn as a director. He goes for it. He doesn't hold back. And I think that is to be applauded.
I absolutely love Matthew Vaughn because he just doesn't give a shit. And I just love that about him. He knows what he wants to do. He doesn't care, you know, what necessarily critics are going to think about it. He's not even thinking necessarily commercially. He's thinking purely artistically. This is his vision. This is what he wants to do. The fact that he finances the film himself means that he can kind of do what he wants. Mm-hmm. And this is the product that he's put out. And it's fantastic. I definitely suggest people go and see it.
Four stars for Kingsman: The Secret Service. Go check it out if you like. And we have a Kingsman special coming up next week. It's not quite a spoiler special because it's not going to involve members of Team Empire getting around and talking about it because we'll probably just dissolve into a fight about the final shot. But nevertheless, we invited Vaughn himself, who's a fantastic interview, very, very frank and very, very funny, to come in and talk about the film and his career and all the spoilerific stuff. So from the church sequence onwards, he talks about all the third act developments. It's a fascinating, very, very funny interview. Great Sean Connery story, I'll give you that. So check that one out. It should be up on Monday or Tuesday. Also out this week, very, very quick. Sadly, we don't have a lot of time left. Also out this week, we have Disney's Big Hero 6, which is a kind of Marvel mashup. It's based on a very little-known Marvel comic called Sunfire and Big Hero 6, about a Japanese superhero team. It's about the bonding between a young boy called Hiro, who's a brilliant teenage inventor, whose brother is killed, and the robot that his brother has built called Baymax, who's a personal healthcare companion, an inflatable bundle of joy and naivety. And they two of them form a partnership while also inadvertently starting a superhero team. For me, this is great fun. Frozen was obviously a phenomenon. It is what it is, a very traditional Disney movie. This, in its own way, is a traditional superhero movie with lashings of comedy, and it's very, very heartfelt as well. And at times, it's brilliant. And you will love Baymax, and you will end up doing Baymax's fist bump. That is a promise to you. And we gave Big Hero 6... 4 stars as well. And also heading this your way this week is Stephen Daldry's Trash, to which we also gave 4 stars, and the Aussie crime drama Son of a Gun with Ewan McGregor and the ubiquitous Alicia Vikander, to which we gave 3 stars. And that's it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun, when we'll be joined by Peter Strickland, director of The Duke of Burgundy, and someone else, because we haven't confirmed another guest yet, and I'm getting a little bit worried. If you're a famous person and you would like to come on the podcast,
do get in touch and by all means come on next week's show. Until then, it's goodbye from James.
I will not let you go.
Have you been Googling lyrics?
Yeah, I was literally thinking Bohemian Rhapsody lyrics. What? Oh, yes. That's
Okay. It's good. It's goodbye from Phil.
I can come in next week as Eric Cantona if you like, but goodbye.
How airy is your house?
It's pretty airy.
It is pretty airy. And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to get one of those sexy spam bots to do a poet tweet. See you next week. Bye-bye.